Good afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rant Show, live on AM770 KTTH. We are streaming live on the KTTH smartphone app. Activists, along with Woke 5 News, they keep claiming housing costs are why there's a homeless problem in Burien and elsewhere. It is the latest politically motivated lie that we're going to get into because it's what's trending.
What's trending? Follow up.
Now, King 5 is reporting that Burien spent over $500,000 in tackling the homelessness issues last year. Now, for a lot of cities, like a Seattle or San Francisco, New York, Chicago, $500,000, that's nothing. That is literally nothing. It is a drop in the bucket. For Burien, it's a lot of money. Now, they say it was spent for homelessness prevention, which indicates it's not just giving money out to organizations helping people who are currently homeless. It's all about helping people who are low income, in addition to the homeless. And for example, they put, for a total night of 1,200, they put a whole bunch of homeless people into shelters. Now, obviously, that's many people, so there's overlap in the nights, but 1,200, that's a lot, and it's expensive. They connected about 1,300 individuals with health services. They had more than almost a quarter million pounds of food distributed amongst people living out on the streets and living low income. Like, that's a lot. Here's Councilmember Hugo Garcia to King 5.
Everything you do really impacts all the issues that we've been dealing with on the council, from homelessness to crime.
Now, as you might imagine, this can cause a financial problem for a city the size of Burien, which is what Mayor Kevin Schilling is pointing out.
As a community, our economy is not set up to match the need in place right now.
So expect dollars from the county, from the state, having to come into the city to help. Now, whenever we talk about homelessness, there's always the either direct or indirect claim that this is really a housing issue. It's about a housing affordability. We hear that over and over and over again. It's too expensive to live here. Because people can't afford the rent, they end up becoming homeless. They're just like me and you, one missed paycheck away from becoming homeless. And they kind of hinted around that when they spoke with the Burien Human Services manager.
It's no surprise, I guess, to us that given the rising rents occurring here in Burien, that people are struggling to make ends meet.
Struggling, sure. Sometimes people struggle. There's no doubt about that. And it's obviously true that if you're low income, economic conditions matter. Hashtag Bidenomics, it turns out, is not really good for people, generally speaking. And if you're low income and you're getting hit with higher costs of living, yeah, that's obviously going to hurt. However, this should not be a part of this conversation. Anything framed around homelessness should not be even introducing the idea that high rent is causing all of this. It really isn't. It's implying numbers that don't quite exist. Is everyone out on the streets dealing with addiction or mental health issues? No, of course not. But a huge chunk are. A huge chunk are. And you look at all of the data on the ground, people who are actually working in social services, they tell you exactly the same thing. And don't forget that when Seattle was part of the lawsuit going after Big Pharma for the opioid crisis, what did they say in their internal documents? What did they say in their lawsuit? They said the majority of the people that at the time, the navigation team, basically social workers along with cops connecting with homeless people, they said the majority of people that we're contacting have a drug addiction. That was a whole bunch. That was a whole bunch. And yet we're supposed to pretend that, oh no, it's because rent is too high. And here's the reality. When talking about Burien, there's a whole lot of pressure on this small city because they're doing things that folks in the homeless industrial complex don't want to have happen and progressives don't want to have happen. They're actually enforcing the law. And that's why you have, for example, the King County Sheriff, Patty Cole Tindall, a political appointment, stepping up and saying, oh yeah, we're not going to enforce your ordinance. Except she didn't say that at first. She secretly told her deputies until we published her email. And then all of a sudden she was like, oh no, yeah, no. But we're going to sue to try to stop this because we think it's unconstitutional. As if that's the role of the sheriff. I also got my hands on an email thread between city staff and leaders and someone named Lisa Dugard. I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but she runs REACH. REACH is a county program, or it works with the county as a diversion program, meaning you put them into this program so the individual who's homeless and addicted to drugs doesn't go to jail. That's essentially all you need to know about REACH. And in this email thread, Dugard calls out the city of Burien, saying Burien police are making drug possession use arrests at a high rate and diverting fewer than 6% of them. She wrote, in the first 2 months of this year, Burien PD made 55 arrests for drug possession, public use. For comparison, this is essentially the same number of arrests for possession and use that the Seattle Police Department made in the same period with a force 16 times larger. It's not actually 16 times, but that tells you more about Seattle and their unwillingness to enforce the law than it does about Burien. But she continues, notwithstanding that pre-booking diversion to community-based care is a standard practice encouraged under state law, Burien police diverted only 5.45% of these cases, 3 of 55. If anything, in the interest of reducing illegal and problematic behavior, we'd love to see that number increase as pre-booking diversion to lead case management and ongoing coordination between case managers, prosecutors, and law enforcement regarding the progress of diverted individuals is known to reduce recidivism and improve outcomes. Let me translate that for you. Putting them in a diversion program that funnels a whole lot of money to these nonprofits, that cuts down on recidivism. Do we have a prolific offender problem? I thought we did. All the data says we do. The data that they're claiming is misleading. I don't think it's accurate. And I can tell you it's not accurate as a matter of fact, because what do we know? As she just kind of pointed out, in Seattle, don't really always enforce the law. And if you're not even making an arrest, you can't be tracking whether or not someone is a prolific offender. You're not tracking the arrests. So spare me just a little bit on the claims that any of this actually works. The data suggests it does not. But we know does work is actually leveraging the criminal justice system, leveraging jail time to put pressure on someone to actually go into treatment. And if they don't, okay, well, then you go to jail. It's really that simple. I mean, if you're breaking the law, if you're going to smoke fentanyl right out in the open, they change the state law. So now we're going to charge. It works in Marysville. It works in cities that actually adopt this general policy. Not for everyone, but it generally works. And yet, we keep getting told over and over and over again by the people who have been in charge this entire time that we should continue to trust them. We should continue to go down that path in which we say, okay, we're not going to use the criminal justice system anymore. We're just going to put people, keep them out of jail, put them in diversion programs. Because we've been doing it this entire time and things have actually gotten worse and we've been spending way more money on it. Does that make any sense whatsoever? I mean, can anyone seriously sit back and say this honestly, things have gotten better in King County when it comes to homelessness over the last few years, over the last decade, over the last, 19 years into the 10-year plan to end homelessness? Have things gotten better or worse? They've clearly gotten worse by all data points. It has gotten worse. More people are living outside. More people are dying of overdoses. We have more drug addiction than we've ever had, ever. So how can anyone say we should be continuing to go down this path in which we give people a pass time and time and time again? What is the argument? The people who are the most passionate about staying there are the ones who benefit. Their budgets benefit, their paychecks benefit. Because I just pulled up the King County Fatal Overdose Dashboard. The vast majority of these cases are homeless people. They don't break it down by homeless, people experiencing housing insecurity. They don't break it down that way. But I know the data, we see this happen all the time. Right now, right this moment, as of March 26th, the confirmed overdose cases are at 238. They've got 53 more that are just pending a toxicology report, but they're suspected of being an overdose. That's a lot, right? I mean, you're almost at 300, and what is it? March 26th. So we're obviously not trending in the right direction. The vast majority of this, the vast majority at 192, is related to fentanyl. Now, it's not just fentanyl. Fentanyl mixed oftentimes with meth. Sometimes it's another drug that they consume, not realizing that it was laced with fentanyl, and they end up dying of a fentanyl overdose. I saw the man die just a few weeks ago on my drive back from Bremerton. I wrote about it at ktth.com. So let's be clear that this approach is not actually working. And yet we continue to double down. And so I look at a city like Burien, and it's not just them that at least they're trying to do the right thing. There are other cities that are trying to do the right thing as well, but they run into resistance, and they're running into resistance from the people who stand to benefit the most, or the organizations, I should say, that stand to benefit the most, when they just try to do things just a little bit differently. And at the end of the day, I will presume for the vast majority of the nonprofit staff members, I will just presume that they are working in good faith. I think Lisa Dugard, for example, she tries to do good. See what I just did? Dugard, do good. I think she thinks what she's doing is right. I think that the folks over at the Low Income Housing Institute or Plymouth Housing, I think they intend to do well by these people. But I also know that it's the left that's been telling me all about unconscious bias nonstop, hitting us over the head with it. Could there might be just a little bit of a tiny unconscious bias when we're talking about moving away from this particular approach, because if you do, the money stops flowing into your groups. Could it be the unconscious part of your brain tells these people, well, if you do actually go after homelessness in a meaningful way and get them off the streets, you do end up losing your job, right? Do you think that plays maybe just a little bit of a role, just a little tiny bit, that might be blinding them to the fact that the idea of just keeping people in subsidized housing for the rest of their lives, that they think that that's a good thing? And God forbid anyone say anything. You're not supposed to say that. Media has decided to very clearly take a side, very clearly side with the permanent supportive housing model, the housing first model, harm reduction. It's the cool, hip thing to do in progressive cities. So they're just pretending that that actually works, and yet they're not showing us any data at all that shows us that approach has had any positive effect. None, which is why they don't lead with those numbers. If they could come out and say, we got 37% of the people who went into our program, 37% of those diversion program people, the graduates, oh, they're on a path to self-sufficiency. They're living on their own. They turn things around. Now, would I like that 37% to be, you know, 97? Sure, but I understand it takes some time. These are sometimes really hard cases. They never do that, do they? Why do you think that is? It's because the data doesn't exist. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Back the blue.
Last night at the Bellevue City Council, there was a pretty significant announcement. They've actually come to a resolution, as we previously reported, to help Officer Kevin Beretta, who was seriously injured while working on the detail for Vice President Kamala Harris. As we told you, he lost his insurance a month ago, and that's obviously something that's unacceptable. Well, the city has now come forward with a fix. Officer Beretta is going to join us in just a few moments, but first we take you through precisely what the fix is with Bellevue City Councilmember Jared Neuenhaus. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jason.
What is the actual fix?
So, well, first of all, I applaud the city manager and the staff for moving so quickly to resolve this issue by developing a change in city policy that will ensure that Officer Beretta's existing medical coverage will continue over the coming months, giving him and his family the ability to focus on recuperating and then hopefully eventually returning to the police department. And what it is a two-year interim solution. We'll provide reimbursement for all insurance premiums, and is available to Officer Beretta and also really to any city employee going forward who experiences a workplace injury or illness resulting in a temporary disability that prevents them from working sufficient hours to maintain those benefits. And, you know, this is the first time we've ever had a had a case like this, in which the length of time to return to work would kind of lapse that coverage. But again, this interim solution was selected because it could be implemented really quickly and address the immediate needs of Officer Beretta and his family. But the city does plan to continue working on a long-term change that would further support the health benefits for all employees in these unique situations. And that interim solution has been agreed to by all the unions, or most of the unions. I know, maybe most importantly in this case, by BPOG, the Bellevue Police Officers Guild. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, together the city and the guild were able to find this solution together, work on this, approve it. And, you know, I think it meets the employee needs, our officers' needs, while also being fiscally sustainable to the city as well.
So I know, obviously, you know, you say that this was done rather quickly. I would respectfully disagree. I suppose in the month, you're 100% correct, right? I mean, there's no doubt that was quick for a month. Yeah. However, this was not a shock to the city of Bellevue. You all knew that this was coming. The city had been in negotiations with the guild for a couple months at least, I believe even 3 or 4 months. So everyone knew that this was going to happen. Why is it that nothing got done until we started talking about this story, and then the media started to pick up on it?
Yeah. Well, I would have to refer you to the city manager's office on that. I can't speak for them, but, you know, I think that they did move as quickly as they possibly can. I mean, personally, Jason, you know, sometimes I get, you know, coming from the private sector, I get frustrated about how slow government can move sometimes. But the bottom line is that we have an interim solution. We're going to get a long-term solution, and we're going to be able to support Officer Beretta on his path to wellness and getting better.
Although, just to be clear, because I'm going to give you we'll give you the high five on this one, because I was told that you were working behind the scenes earlier than the news story actually came out, trying to address this issue. Is that correct?
Sure. No, I was certainly advocating for Officer Beretta and to get this situation addressed as quickly as possible.
Yeah. So, and I point that out only to say, because again, everyone knew about this as an inevitability, and I really do wonder, if this didn't get any press attention, would we be here today? Now, at the end of the day, beggars can't be choosers. I will happily take this news. It's obviously very good news, and Officer Beretta is going to join us in just a second here to react. But, you know, it did take a little bit of a while in the grand scheme of things. Maybe by government standards, it was a little bit faster. Just very quickly, do you think the city handled this at the initial start of the news coverage? Do you think they handled this appropriately?
Well, I mean, listen, so it's, you know, given that this had never happened before, the city had never had a situation where an employee was so injured so severely, like in the case of Officer Beretta. I think we all wish we could have addressed this quicker. But again, I will applaud the city manager's office for getting this done as quickly as possible, looking at all the different options, finding a solution, moving that forward. So, I think we all would have preferred that it move more quickly, but we're here now. We have a great solution here, and most importantly, I'm just glad that we're going to be able to support the family, support Officer Beretta, and I will. And personally, I also hope that you know, this sends the message that, you know, for future incidents like this, that and for any first responder in the city that does suffer an injury like that, that we're going to be here to support them and their family in their time of need. I really hope, because, you know, on your show as well, at times, Jason, there was some questions about, well, I thought the city of Bellevue supported the men and women in blue. And we do. Yes, it took longer than it needed to, perhaps, but we got there, and we will always have their back.
There you go. Bellevue City Councilmember Jared Newenhouse, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Again, that was Bellevue City Councilmember Jared Newenhouse. Joining us on the line with an exclusive reaction is Officer Kevin Beretta. Officer, obviously, this is good news for you. When did you first hear about it?
I heard about it about a week ago, that it was in the works. It sounds like they kind of solidified it this last week and announced it at the city council meeting last night. So
what are your general thoughts? I mean, it feels in a lot of ways like this could have been a little bit more open, so you wouldn't have had to go to the media. We wouldn't have had to cover this at all.
Yeah, I mean, we ended up covering it, and it came out with a positive outcome. We have, a total of 18 months of coverage, if needed. So, I mean, that's huge, and that's for every law enforcement officer on Bellevue PD, and even for anybody that works for the city of Bellevue. So, in the end, this is a good step forward, and it's a big win for everybody. Like I said in our last interview, I think it needs to change at the state level. I think we need to move farther with this. So I think there's still some more work to do. And I'll see how I'm going to try to navigate that here in the next coming year when I get back to work.
How did this get done behind the scenes? Was it your team working with the city? I know the Guild was really involved.
Behind the scenes, it was the Guild. I believe it's the Guild and the city. We're doing the negotiations, and then they presented me with what they came up with. So
the last time we spoke, obviously you had some harsh words for the city of Bellevue, certainly the HR department, which, you know, you pointed out didn't treat you with a whole lot of compassion. They were pretty cold. Does your view of the city change at all as a result of all of this?
I don't think so. I think that going forward, maybe if they make some changes quicker than what they did in this situation, it can change. But I'm glad that they came to their senses and provided and did the right thing.
Yeah, no kidding. How are you feeling? How are things developing?
I feel good. I feel good about the situation. Like I said, it's a step forward. The city provided what we asked for. It was medical benefits. It was kind of a bummer I didn't get some supplemental pay to equal out what I also wanted. But that's okay. It wasn't really about me 100%. This is going forward for everybody. So this is a step forward to make things better for everybody.
How's the recovery going?
Same spot as last time, just still working at it, doing everything every day that I can. There's not a day I don't do something to make myself better. So,
yeah. Are you seeing improvement?
I am seeing improvement. Yes, sir.
That's awesome. Well, we wish you the best of luck as you continue to recover. I know this is going to be still a long road ahead, but at least one of the issues that do not have to burden you, at least for now, will be this coverage over the next 18 months. Hopefully, though, you won't have to use it for 18 months, and that's what we're all hoping for.
That's what I'm hoping for, too.
Ah, perfect. Well, we wish you the best of luck. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Jason Rancho. When we come back, we're going to dive into the big local. Don't forget, our local tax expert, Greg Nunn, wants taxpayers to know the IRS is going after older cases very aggressively. So if you received a form CP-504 from the IRS, do not ignore it. Be proactive. Resolve your situation by calling Greg Nunn of Nunn Better Tax Resolution. Google NUNN, Nunn Better Tax Resolution.
You know who doesn't want to fund the reconstruction of Gaza? Everybody within 1,000 miles of the reconstruction of Gaza. The story they're not reporting tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. on The Brian Suit Show.
Mercer Island, Des Moines.
This is the Big Local on the Jason Ranch Show.
Shoreline, Woodinville, Burien.
Stories about you, not about Seattle.
Hey, look at that, 4:30 on a weekday afternoon. That means it's time for the Big Local. It's brought to you by Alpine Specialty Services. They're online at alpineclean.com. This is the part of the show where we completely ignore the stories coming out of Seattle and instead focus all of our attention on the communities you live in and care about most. We have an update on 18-year-old Chase Jones of Kent. Prosecutors say he was driving 112 miles per hour. He ran a red light before plowing into a van in Renton. He ended up killing 4 people, they say, including 3 children. Well, we now know that he's not the best driver. He's not the safest driver. And we knew that well before this incident. well before this incident. He's been involved in two significant crashes, according to Como TV. Jeremy Harris took a deep dive into this kid's background and found the first incident was in May of last year, and there was body camera footage as law enforcement officers were talking to him after the accident that apparently was due to speeding. That's what he said.
I saw an open road. I was definitely going above speed limit 25.
I don't have the money.
I'm not sure I was not looking.
If you had to guess.
40-50.
I was definitely going above the speed limit of 25, 40-50. That's what it says. That's what I heard. And police were warning him about the speeding, knowing that this is obviously dangerous behavior, hoping that he would have learned a lesson here.
Mistake. It's happened. Lesson to be learned. You learn it, right?
Nobody's hurt.
Right.
These are cars.
Nobody's hurt because they're cars. They were empty cars. They were parked cars that he crashed into, according to the prosecutors. Now, unfortunately, he didn't learn his lesson. Because not long after that, in January of this year, Como TV reports that he had that second major crash, totaling his car, also speeding, according to the prosecutors. In fact, again, on body cam footage, a victim who was there, who saw this all unfold, said he was driving so fast, he could barely see the car even coming.
By the time I got out there, there was just a pair of lights, and they were going so fast.
Now, in that case, he was driving an Audi, one that he purchased a month before this accident. Now, the first thing that comes to mind, or the first question I had, was could something have been done, legally speaking, that we chose not to do that could have prevented him from driving the way he allegedly was driving? And unless there's a detail that we just haven't seen yet, the answer seems to be no. I looked it up on the Department of Licensing website. You need three convictions on a moving violation within a 12-month period to have your license revoked. Or within a 24-month period, you would have four separate moving violations. So presumably, he got two tickets in this case. He had two moving violations, so it wasn't the third. In fact, unfortunately, the Renton one appears to be the third. And by the way, this is what we know so far. So I don't know if there would be anything that can be done or could have been done to prevent this from happening in the first place. And so then we ask ourselves, well, why did this happen at all? Why is this a kid who apparently chooses to drive like this? Some people, you know, Brian Suits was talking about it a little bit this morning about how particularly amongst young boys, but men, they like to speed. They like to drive very, very fast. And this could just be a kid doing something stupid, except, you know, you get into one accident, usually will course correct, right? That accident will cause you to course correct. A second one most definitely would for most people. Only to then, according to prosecutors, drive 112 miles per hour speeding through a red light. This is a kid who should never have been driving. This is a result, most likely, of bad parenting. I mean, just think about it from your perspective as a parent. If you've got a kid, 18, 17, 16, whatever, wouldn't you put up a little bit of a fight? Just a little bit when your kid said he wants to get a new car that presumably you purchased for him? I know he's 18 and it's a little bit different, but it's not that different. I sincerely doubt he paid for the car himself, a new Audi. And that was the last one that got totaled. So he had a new car. He didn't pay for it himself. I can't imagine that. This was done by the parents. That's my guess. Does he come from a broken family? Don't know. You know, we talk about all the different paths that kids can go down when they don't have a loving family, when they don't have a responsible family, when they come from a broken family. This is a kid going down the wrong path. It's just a slightly different wrong path. When you have bad parents, you have bad kids, period. Now, obviously, mistakes do get made. People screw up, kids especially. 18-year-olds, definitely. But this is more than just a mistake. Or an awful lot of mistakes that apparently he didn't learn his lesson on. So, I wouldn't be shocked if we learned even more once we get more details, once people go into his background, I'd be shocked if we didn't learn some more. And I'm curious how hard the prosecutors are truly going to go after him, or is it going to end in yet another plea deal? Maybe plea down some of the, just have one charge against him.
Well, he's 18.
Yeah, I don't care. There's two 13-year-olds and a 12-year-old who won't ever get to hit 18. There's a mom who no longer gets to see her kids, all taken because of this guy, allegedly. Meanwhile, in Spokane, the city council, a little upset that the governor has decided here in Washington not to declare a homelessness state of emergency. They are now going to perhaps spend their own money or find out where they're going to get it to basically put out more data on the drug crisis. We talked about this the other day, in that depending on where it is you live, you either have access to a lot of really important data that's out there for us to better understand the crisis, or the opposite. And for the most part, and really the only county that I think is doing the drug crisis data well is actually King County. That's the one thing that they actually do well. They report these drug overdoses very quickly. But when you go into Pierce County, Snohomish County, you're not getting the data as easily. And so over in Spokane, they're saying, yeah, we want a dashboard. We want to get this information. Because they were looking at their own data that was compiled on the back end, and they're seeing something that is terrifying to them. Remember, last year was a record high for drug overdoses across the state. They are seeing in Spokane a 30% increase in police or fire calls for suspected overdoses. They had nearly 250, according to the spokesman review, between January 1 and February 7th. 250. That's a lot. That's more than 6 overdose calls a day. And so the data, they hope, more readily available, will help to, you know, inspire people to maybe do something. When you get these kind of data points and they're readily available and you actually look for them, it does start to paint a slightly different picture about the problem. It becomes a little bit more real. As morbid as this might be, King County now every single day will upload the medical examiner office results of autopsies. They'll tell you how someone died, who died. They'll give you their name, their age, where it happened, indoors, outdoors, whether it was a drug overdose that was accidental. Like, they'll tell you all of that every single day. And you look at that and you realize, okay, it's not just a number. It was a person. A person who was living a life, who was ravaged by drug addiction, didn't get to fulfill a life. And the vast majority of these cases, the vast majority, are drug overdoses. Go look at the King County Public Health website. It's very easy to find. Okay, it's not that easy. You can go to ktth.com and click on the link that I have in one of my blogs. I had to email them and say, can you give me the link? I cannot find it anywhere. Where is it? They do make it a little bit more difficult. But once you're actually there, there's some really good information. So I hope that they end up pushing forward with this and do it in Spokane. And then finally in Kent, we actually now have video of the suspected hate crime that suspiciously news stopped reporting on once they recognized that maybe this wasn't a case of a white dude attacking a black woman on a bus. Remember this story? This is March 7th. And I remember because I was getting trolled by my normal trolls on Twitter, who were saying, oh, look at what your hate radio inspired. No doubt one of your listeners just attacked this black woman on a Kent bus. She was there. She was getting harassed by this guy, allegedly. She goes up to the driver, the bus driver, say, okay, I need you to call 911. I'm being harassed by this guy. She's about to get off, and she's almost like 1 foot out the door when this dude is seen on the camera just pummeling her. Just absolutely pummeling her. She manages to get out. She goes away from the camera inside of the bus. And I've got all the feeds. I'm going to post the video up on our Twitter account later tonight. And that's when he allegedly stabbed her. He just stabbed me with a knife, bus driver. You know what saved her from at least serious injury? She was wearing a puffy jacket that was really thick. And so the knife was not able to puncture her skin, I don't even think. So she got really, really lucky. Now, this was suspected as a hate crime. And I remember the initial reports of she was the victim of slurs that were apparently being thrown her way. So people jumped on this immediately. And like I said, I got hit up by the same trolls as they normally do when there's a story like this that they can exploit and pretend. Well, it's a listener of yours. It's hate radio's fault. And then they gave out the suspect's name. Aiden Hernandez Mayoral. And then all of a sudden, it was like, well, he doesn't sound very white. This is not a white supremacist. Ah, whatever. Never mind. Okay, we're not going to cover it. Okay, producer, stand down. Stand down. It's not the kind of hate crime that we like looking at. Stand down. No, put the facing race team away for now. We'll send them to some Native American art festival next week. Don't worry. That's basically how it always... Don't give me that look. That's exactly what happens. It just seems odd that it just went away. I'm just saying. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. 1-800-465-8770. And I suspect that you do want to send me a text because you get to pick the news when we come back. Story number one. Costco is cracking down on its food court. Now you need to show your membership card to eat there. What does that mean? And why do people care about the stupid hot dogs? My God. Or story number two. You know that whole thing about going into like a ice cold shower or an ice bath? It's supposed to be really, really good for you. Is it actually? Because there's new research out that maybe gets people to question whether or not that's a smart idea. 1-800-465-8770. You can send me your text. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
You pick the topic on The Jason Rant Show.
Indeed you do, and you want to join me in laughing at these people who decided to jump into ice-cold baths or showers. It's called cold therapy. And for some reason, it just sort of popped up out of nowhere. Just all of a sudden, everyone's all like, oh, you should do this. It's good for inflammation and whatnot. And apparently, according to researchers at the University of Warwick in the UK, they looked at 9 separate studies specifically about cold therapy along with like breathing and meditation, all that garbage. And I'm kidding. It's not garbage. They say, although the method was found to reduce inflammation, Fox News says the researchers concluded that the, quote, quality of the studies is very low and that all the results must be interpreted with caution. They also noted that the studies had small sample sizes, so they can't be applied to the general population. And they ended up publishing their results in a medical journal that all of you probably read every single quarter, PLOS One. You know that one, PLOS One. It's a great one. You don't get a subscription?
Oh, an avid reader.
I get it on my Kindle. I'm such a fan. It costs like $733 a year, though. It's a medical journal. They're so expensive. I don't know. Bidenomics, maybe it is good. Everyone has a subscription. They say it. I've never actually heard of this. It's called the Wim Hof method. That's what it's called. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
I just hear cold therapy.
I didn't go to medical school, so.
You know, you think any of these people are promoting this on their Instagram account went to medical school? And it's always like the people from the paleo groups or what is the other one? It's not paleo. What's the other one?
Like a naturopath? I don't
know. No, oh my God, what is it? Do you know? How do you, oh my God, you guys are the worst. Why am I getting targeted with these things on Instagram? It's like the natural eating, but they eat like a caveman. That, whatever that thing is called. And it's always gross. He's always got like an uncooked liver in his hand and he takes a bite out of a lamb's heart. It's like, oh my God. It's always those people who push this nonsense. And they say it's based on the philosophy and practices of Dutch athlete Wim Hof. Duh, dummy. Why didn't you know that? Don't you know Wim Hof? Did you know he was a Dutch athlete of some kind? What he did, I don't know. The method has 3 pillars: cold plunging, breathing, and mindset. Previous research has shown that the method can have multiple mental and physical health benefits. Hof previously told Fox News Digital that a chief benefit of this method is reducing inflammation. Now, by the way, that technically makes sense to me, right? It's very cold. Inflammation can be then not eradicated completely, but we hear these kinds of things on a non-crazy ice bath basis. So that does kind of make sense. They say when you reduce your inflammation, you're going to be overall more healthy. It can not necessarily cure some diseases, but it could alleviate some of the symptoms. And in some cases, it actually can lead to disease, the inflammation. So obviously, if you get rid of it or you mitigate the impacts, you're going to be much healthier. They said, I'm bringing my knowledge from nature through science to global. The first time you hear someone say, I'm bringing my knowledge of nature to anything related to health, it's should be at least seen as a little bit of a red flag that you're hearing from a kook. Not always. And some of what they say is totally valid, and there's lots of reasons to trust them. A little red flag should go up when someone mentions nature. They say showing that through science, not speculation, we are able to do so much more within our physiology. He says in addition to reducing inflammation, he credited cold therapy with improving his mental health during a difficult time in his life. That's the part that I actually do think there's probably a benefit. And maybe it's not a benefit that you can truly test. It's more about how you feel. What happens when you go into a cold bath? What happens? You get really cold. You're very uncomfortable. You hate it. You probably hate every moment of it. But you're not going to die from, unless it's, I mean, it's crazy cold. You're not going to die from this. You'll be very uncomfortable for 10 seconds to 5 minutes, however long you're staying in there. But your mental state at the moment can get you to overcome a lot of, maybe not all, but a lot of the discomfort. And to prove to yourself that you're able to get through a pretty difficult time, difficult in air quotes, maybe means when something in your life is causing a whole lot of stress or distress, you're able to cope a little bit better. Because if you can cope with going into a freezing cold shower or taking a plunge into, an ice cold lake in the middle of the winter, maybe then everything else that you might experience in your day won't seem so daunting. And I've heard that from some people. And perhaps it's all a placebo effect. Okay. There's nothing wrong sometimes with placebo effect if it's making you feel better mentally. Now, the study's lead researcher said, the key takeaways from the review indicate the promising use of this method in the inflammatory response category. However, it's crucial to note that all studies included exhibit a high concern for risk bias indicating the early stages of investigation into this method. While some positive effects are observed, such as attenuation of inflammation, the overall benefits remain uncertain. So, in other words, what they're saying is that, yeah, your inflammation might go down, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's to a benefit. It doesn't mean it's to a detriment either. It says the researchers uncovered many limitations in the studies they reviewed. Quote, all the trials had a very high risk of bias due to the lack of prior published protocol, small sample size, and complexity of blinding the participants and outcome assessors to the intervention. That's actually kind of interesting. They're saying part of the difficulties, because you can't have a test group that you like a placebo effect kind of thing where they know they're going into cold water. You can't hide that part. That's actually really interesting. I never even thought about that. They say psychological outcomes were also difficult to measure. I just said that. The researchers noted, as they relied on subjective input in response to a questionnaire. Since the participants were not blinded, it was very difficult to ensure that the answers were honest and valid to the experience, the researcher told Fox News. Then they get into all these other people who basically have been making a whole lot of money off of this. I've come to accept that a lot of the health advice that you get, especially if it's coming from like Instagram and whatnot, probably wrong. So the question for me is it harmful if you do it? And if the answer is no, and you feel like you're benefiting from it, it's probably overall fine. Now, you might die if you listen to that advice, so don't listen to me, listen to your doctors. But if you truly do get a positive mental outcome out of all of this, and just from a medical perspective, it's not going to kill you or harm you in any way, I think that that's a win. To me, that's a win. So if you want, keep jumping into a cold pool in the middle. I don't want to do that because I'm mentally already pretty strong. As a talk show host, I'm someone who is perfect in most every single way. And the one thing you need as a talk show host is like mental fortitude. And I already have that, so I don't need to actually jump into a pool. But I would like to push someone. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. 1-800-465-8770. 8770. Don't forget to become a podcast subscriber. On the Jason Rand Show feed, you get an absolutely free extra podcast every day.